Here on FM, our Book of the Week, Meryl Seacrest's biography of Elsa Schiaparelli. In the early 1930s, Schiaparelli employed 400 people and worked with Salvador Dali, producing ever more outrageous outfits. Having opened a showroom in London and found success in America by 1935, she's ready to move into new premises in Paris. The reader is Abigail Thaw.
The Place Vendôme, with its wide-open pavements, is dominated by a statue of Napoleon. From her window, Schiaparelli could clearly see the silhouette of the little Corsican. On the ground floor, there was an innovation. Ready-to-wear. The idea that someone could walk in, buy something and take it away was audacious in the days when couturiers laboriously worked at individual measurements. It was the first real Parisian boutique. She called it Schiap. The second-floor showrooms are dominated by a grand curving staircase from which mannequins made their stately descent, and for the opening collection on February 5, 1935, the place was packed. In April, Vogue commissioned Cecil Beaton to design a page devoted to Schiaparelli's ideas of the moment, chintz beach hats in newspaper prints, Tyrolean flowers running around a belt of calf leather, a fan of crumpled fabric made of glass, a choker of huge beads tied with a crepe handkerchief, and gloves made from alternating leather and Irish crochet. She continued to experiment and came up with rhodophane, a so-called glass fabric, fragile and brittle, that had to be interwoven with ribbon strips of silk, rayon or metal to keep it from tearing, and that, the story goes, disintegrated once the object was sent to the dry cleaner. She worked more closely than ever with textile designs of her own imaginings. Shaggy furs made of metal, moirés in metallic gunmetal, wrinkled velvets, fabrics made from tree bark. The world was descending on the Paris Salon, including stars of theatre and film, European as well as Hollywood. Schiaparelli clearly had a knack that other designers lacked. With Marlene Dietrich, for instance, whose presentation of a certain look was already well established, Schiaparelli added the softening effects of a large black fur hat and oversized fox fur collar that hugged the neckline. From being formidable, the great star became approachable and cuddly. In 1937, she was asked to dress Mae West for the film Every Day's a Holiday, set at the turn of the century when the shape of a woman's body was at its most pronounced. Mae West sent her measurements in absentia, in the form of a plaster lookalike. Schiaparelli came up with something form-fitting and flamboyant that cleverly added height and detracted from the matronly expanse of bosom and hip. The outfit was created in pale lilac and decorated with an Art Nouveau band of pink and mauve that went from shoulder to hip. By the time they reached the West Coast, however, her creations had to be redone. Mae West's weight had shot up, and she had to be shown in darker dresses with darker colours behind her so that her outlines would blend in with the background. Schiaparelli's designs for Mae West helped to launch one of the most wildly successful gambles she ever took, a new line of perfume. Designers linking their names with perfumes went back to the end of World War I. Chanel, for instance, launched her floral bouquet, the enduring Chanel No. 5, in 1921. Schiaparelli's perfume, along with the colour for which she is also best known, came together almost simultaneously. Roger Jean-Pierre showed Schiaparelli a collection of new button designs by Jean Clément, including a set in a rose pink. One of the colours was more than rosy, it was strident, blazing. Elsa Schiaparelli looked at it a bit shocked but also thrilled. "Oh, Roger, I am going to take this one and we are going to call it Shocking Pink." The vibrant pink took off almost at once and invaded every conceivable item of clothing. Women's wear daily tracked it as far as hats, which were usually in neutral colours to blend in better with whatever someone was wearing. Everywhere you go, you are greeted with entire hats or hat trimmings in the daring, sometimes glaring, petunia pink shades, which all started with Schiaparelli's shocking. The name was also appropriate for the perfume, which had a heavy, lingering, almost sultry appeal. But what was really risque was the decision to bottle it in a torso shape, practically a nude Mae West. From 1935 to 1939, Schiaparelli was at the height of her powers, with collections that kept her clients astonished and delighted. She wrote, "Creating fashion is terribly exhausting. It is a daily fight, a weekly battle, a monthly war." Yet she eclipsed everyone, including Chanel. Some said Coco Chanel was not much of a human being, wily, grasping, opportunistic, anti-Semitic, and a terrible snob. Bettina Bergeri detested her. "She talks faster than a sewing machine. She has the cruel eyes of a swan and the beak of Donald Duck." Yet it had to be conceded that the great couturière had blazed a trail that younger women had followed. Of course they were rivals, privately damning each other with faint praise. Chanel called Schiaparelli "that Italian woman who makes dresses." At one of the great costume balls, Bettina wrote, Chanel dared Schiaparelli, dressed as a surrealist tree, to dance with her. With purposeful innocence, Chanel steered her dance partner straight into a chandelier ablaze with candles, and Schiaparelli caught fire. The fire was put out by delighted guests, squirting her with soda water. Schiaparelli's collections at the end of the 1930s outdid themselves in splendor and surprise. There was a pagan collection, with embroideries of sinuously trailing vines of blossoms in silver and pink sequins over a black crepe evening dress. There was her musical collection, more opportunities for embroideries of all manner of gilt metallic bells, silver tambourines, violins, cymbals, horns, even a piano keyboard at neckline, waist and hips. There was another triumphant collection inspired by the Commedia dell'arte, appropriate for a designer born in Italy, in blazing theatrical shades of green, red, blue, pink and yellow. In August 1939, Britain and France declared war on the Third Reich, and the Place Vendôme headquarters fitted out its basement as a shelter. At the first sign of trouble, all work stopped and the Schiaparelli staff retreated there. Schiap herself recalled that the first air raid came one lunch hour. The aeroplanes flew so low that they nearly cut off Napoleon's head. Everyone was prepared for the immediate bombardment of Paris, as had happened during World War I, but none came. The establishment was open for business, but there was little to be had. The staff was working half-time and the men were gone. Belgium was now under attack and refugees were streaming into Paris. At one point, Schiaparelli had 30 refugees sleeping in the house and gave orders that bread and hot coffee were to be always available for the new arrivals. Her European clientele had by now stopped ordering clothes, and many of her colleagues in the small world of haute couture had closed their doors. A Paris department store had constructed an air raid shelter as a backdrop for a range of warm clothing, padded waistcoats, fleecy hoods and all-in-one outfits. These could be donned over pyjamas and zipped up in a matter of seconds. Schiaparelli, as ever on top of the news, if not in front of it, was ready with her own version of what would be called the siren suit. It had wide legs and a fitted bodice, with pockets large enough to carry identity papers and torches. There was also a carry-all, more than a handbag, to encompass a gas mask, a first aid kit, and the regulation powder puff and lipstick. Like other houses, she emphasised the military theme in silhouettes, details and colours, especially colours. There were torch pink, Maginot line blue, aeroplane grey, trench brown and Foreign Legion red. Everything was pared down and covered up. By the time the new designs were shown, Schiaparelli's staff of 600 had dwindled to 150 workers, and the whole collection was put together in 3 weeks. This was too short a time for accessories like handbags, but as women were having to do without their cars, travelling in buses and on the metro, why not give them nice roomy pockets? A case in point was a hooded greatcoat of stunning red wool, which had sizable rectangular pockets attached to each side of its skirt. At 5 in the morning, in mid-June, a friend who was in the cabinet telephoned me. "Schiap, the Germans will be in Paris in a few hours. I advise you for many reasons to leave immediately." She and a skeleton staff had been offered accommodation in Biarritz, so she made immediate plans to go on ahead, preparing for the arrival of about 20 of her staff. Schiaparelli's overriding concern was to finish the work on her new collection and get it shipped to New York while there was still time. One by one, tired and hungry, her devoted workers arrived and were housed in makeshift quarters. Before they could finish the collection, the Germans were almost at Bordeaux and all transport had stopped. Paris fell on June the 14th, and the armistice was signed on June the 22nd. She wrote, "When the capitulation announcement was made, the workpeople, standing in a crush at the door, burst into tears." A few months earlier, Schiaparelli had signed a contract with the Columbia Lecture Bureau in America for a coast-to-coast tour. Under the circumstances, she decided to leave at once. She had designed a simple wardrobe, which had already been shipped. 5 of her staff agreed to return to Paris and reopen the boutique. The remaining dozen or so workers, now staying at the house in Biarritz, were invited to remain there since the rent had been paid for a year. Her bank accounts had been frozen, and she wrote, "The terrible moment for me came when I had to tell my people I could not pay them. I could only divide the cash I had with me." She arrived in New York with 4 suitcases and $70,000 worth of jewellery on the 20th of July, 1940. She had managed to make sure that her daughter Gogo got out of Italy just before the country declared war on the Allies. Schiaparelli's position during those war years was highly ambiguous. She managed to travel back and forth across the Atlantic at a time when very famous people were being turned back. She managed to convince her American sponsors of her undivided loyalty while swearing undying love for Britain and telling the Germans of her admiration for the Third Reich. Her right-hand woman, Bettina Bergerie, was married to Gaston Bergerie, architect of the Vichy government in France. Her French lawyer, Armand Albert Grégoire, represented high Nazi officials in France, and she was friendly with Otto Abetz, the German ambassador to Vichy France during World War II. The philosopher Isaiah Berlin said, "To survive, you might have needed to do business with the Germans, whether as a waiter or a shoemaker, but you did not have to be cozy with them." If Schiaparelli was a collaborator, as the FBI suspected, it would explain why her salon in Paris remained untouched during the war. But as she embraced Gogo that summer in New York, at least she was alive.
Abigail Thaw was reading from Elsa Schiaparelli, a biography by Meryl Seacrest. It's abridged by Libby Spurrier, produced by Joanna Green, and is a peer production for BBC Radio 4. How many cooks does it take to make a Woman's Hour Christmas dinner? Allegra McEfferty, Yotam Ottolenghi and Trina Hanneman rustle up a mouth-watering roast goose with marmalade glaze and root mash. Now there's a challenge for the new studio cooker.
Since October, Serial has become a global podcast sensation. Now on BBC Radio 4 Extra.
For the last year, I've spent every working day trying to figure out where a high school kid was for an hour after school one day in 1999.
From the creators of This American Life, Serial investigates a real-life murder case.
So he wanted an alibi?
Yes.
I just sometimes wish, like, they could, like, look into my brain.
and see how I really felt about it.
Serial continues every evening at 9 over on BBC Radio 4 Extra and then available on the Radio 4 Extra website.